My presidential address this morning is on innovation. Innovation is a hot topic these days. In a recent poll of 1,500 CEOs from around the world, the number one leadership quality of the future is the ability to innovate. This is particularly true in our specialty. We all know how fast medicine is changing, and we must be at the forefront of this change. As A.G. Lafley, former CEO of the highly innovative company Procter & Gamble, states, innovation is the central job of every leader, business unit manager, functional leaders, and the CEO. This year, the STS went through its strategic planning process, and not surprisingly, innovation came out as a major goal and objective from the discussion. This morning, I hope you get to give you an introduction to the methods that you can use to improve your innovation skills. Innovation is about new things, improvements. The very word exudes optimism. It allows us to have better ways to communicate with our families, learn faster and in a variety of different ways, and for cardiothoracic surgeons, new ways to bring life-saving treatments to our patients. There are many definitions for the term innovation. In 2010, a popular innovation blog listed over 25 separate definitions. For me, I'm going to steal Dartmouth College and Harvard Business School graduate Scott D. Anthony's definition and define innovation with five simple words: something different that has impact. Notice that I've left out any mention of technology. You don't need a degree in electrical engineering to innovate. There's also no mention of creativity. Creativity is a part of innovation, but innovation is much more than just coming up with an idea. It involves developing the idea and following through to make a difference. Remember, no impact, no innovation. The word different needs a bit of clarification. Innovation is in the eye of the beholder, and the target of the innovation should see the difference, as a patient would see an innovative procedure as different. Also, the word impact has some nuance associated with it. Impact means some kind of measurable result: a profit, improved performance of an operation, or a better cure rate of a procedure. I want to start with a story that illustrates many of the points about innovation that I want to highlight today. It's a story that most of you are familiar with, so please forgive me if some of my history is in error. The story is about a 1927 Jefferson Medical graduate who, after a two-year rotating internship at the Pennsylvania Hospital, had taken a position as a research assistant to the great Dr. Edward Churchill of the Massachusetts General Hospital in Boston. In the fall of 1930, Dr. Churchill and his residents went to see a patient who had suddenly become hypotensive and short of breath several days after a cholecystectomy. They were pretty sure that she had thrown a large pulmonary embolism, and they were going to attempt a pulmonary embolectomy, a fairly risky operation even today, and especially back in 1930. They decided to wait until she was almost dead to operate. So Dr. Churchill's resident was assigned to sit at the bedside and record her vital signs every 15 minutes and let Dr. Churchill know when she was about to die. Early the next morning, as expected, she was moribund. It was taken to the operating to remove the embolus, but she did not survive the operation. Of course, this resident was Dr. John H. Gibbon, and this experience made him realize that if he could somehow remove her unoxygenated blood and oxygenate it and return it to her, she may have survived the ordeal. In the next few weeks, he decided this would be a good research project for him to work on. Dr. Churchill thought this wasn't such a great project, since it had little chance of success, so he only allocated a small lab in the basement of the hospital. Not to be discouraged, Dr. Gibbon returned to Philadelphia to complete his surgical training, and then came back to the MGH, where in 1934 he built a working heart-lung machine that could sustain the circulation of a cat for about 30 minutes. There were many problems with this machine. The flow was low, only 150 to 400 milliliters per minute. There was no protamine, so reversing the anticoagulation was difficult, and hemolysis was constant. Gibbon received little support for his innovation from the MGH, so he moved back to Philadelphia and worked at the University of Pennsylvania. By 1937, now 3 years later, he was able to sustain a cat circulation for a week or more. With the Second World War breaking out, his laboratory work was interrupted, and he left for the Army Medical Corps in 1942. Returning to Philadelphia in 1945 and moved to the Jefferson Medical College. He resumed his work on the heart-lung machine, but needed a larger machine to support larger animal experiments. Here's where a bit of good luck enters the story. By chance, E.J. Clark, who was a medical student at Jefferson at the time, was assigned to work in Dr. Gibbons' lab. The medical student had been a pilot in the war and was engaged to the daughter of the president of Lafayette College, who happened to be a good friend of Thomas J. Watson, the president of IBM. Clark thought that Mr. Watson would be interested in the development of Gibbons' machine, so he arranged a meeting between Watson and Gibbons. Indeed, Mr. Watson was excited and assigned his best engineer, Gustav Malmros, to help Gibbons with the project, and perhaps more importantly, provided funding for the research. They developed three different machines, one eventually used for the first successful operation. It was a huge device, weighing over a ton and very complex, but it could provide for a flow of up to 5 liters per minute and provide 100% of the oxygenation of the blood. By February 1952, after some 22 years after his initial experience with the pulmonary embolism, they went ahead with clinical applications. The first patient was a 15-month-old child thought to have an atrial septal defect. They went on bypass, opened the heart, but no ASD was found, and unfortunately the patient rapidly deteriorated and died. Postmortem revealed a patent ductus arteriosus, not an ASD. Even back then, cardiology led surgeons astray. The second patient was an 18-year-old college student with right heart failure. She had an ASD, and on May 6, 1953, Dr. Gibbons placed her on the machine and was able to successfully close the defect. This picture shows some notes from that historic operation. Dr. Gibbons made two phone calls that evening, one to Clarence Crayford and the other to Alfred Blalock, telling them the good news. Surprisingly, he did only two more operations with the machine. 2 months later, he tried to repair an ASD on a 5-year-old without success, and another with a misdiagnosed ventricular septal defect and a patent ductus arteriosus who also died. Dr. Gibbons decided not to attempt any more operations using his machine and turned the cardiac surgical service over to Dr. John Templeton. Gibbons' machine was eventually used as the basis for the Mayo cardiac machine, which was developed and perfected by Dr. John W. Kirkland at the Mayo Clinic with the assistance of IBM engineers. This story demonstrates several key points about innovation. First, leadership often does not see the same vision as the innovators. Dr. Churchill was a brilliant surgeon, a great educator, bringing surgical residency into the modern era. However, he dismissed a great idea that would go on to have major impact in surgery. This faulty vision is something that occurs all the time. Second, innovation is difficult to do. It took Dr. Gibbons from 1930 to 1953, some 23 years, to accomplish his vision. Innovation is not easy. It requires hard work. Thomas Edison, the famous inventor, said, "If you're not sweating, you're not innovating." Finally, innovation requires follow-through. Dr. Gibbons did not follow through on his success. Why did he quit heart surgery? Denton Cooley later said of Gibbons' work, "One success and three deaths doesn't seem to be that great." However, Dr. Gibbons is still recognized as the inventor of the heart-lung machine. Perhaps with follow-through, he could have been even more. Innovation is not limited to the geniuses that we think of when we hear the word innovation. Steve Jobs, Mark Zuckerberg, Richard Branson, Jeff Bezos, Elon Musk. These people are thought of as the great innovators of our time. When you ask most people why these individuals can innovate so successfully, they think it's from a genetic endowment. Their brains are just wired differently, is a common comment. Research does not support this theory. Research on innovation shows that it is a specific set of skills. It can be presented just as any discipline, and it can be learned and it can be practiced. By applying the known principles of innovation, almost anyone can be a successful innovator. In their book, The Innovator's DNA, Jeff Dwyer, Hal Gregersen, and Clayton Christensen interviewed hundreds of inventors of revolutionary products and services, as well as CEOs from innovative companies. They found that their stories were eerily similar, and a consistent set of skills was present in these people. Through these interviews, they discovered that these innovative people think differently, to paraphrase the well-known Apple slogan. People that are good at innovation have five important skills. They were good at linking together ideas that were different, a skill the authors called associational thinking. The innovators were also good at questioning, observing, networking, and experimenting. The authors state that the ability to generate innovative ideas is not merely a function of the mind, but also a function of behaviors. This implies that if we could learn and develop these specific behaviors, associative thinking, questioning, networking, observing, and experimenting, we can improve our innovation skills. By understanding and engaging in the five discovery skills, you can find ways to more successfully develop the creative spark within yourself and others. Steve Jobs, founder and CEO of Apple Incorporated, has stated, "Creativity is just connecting things. Associating the ability to make surprising connections across areas of knowledge, industries, even geographies, is a skill that is well developed in innovators. They were able to synthesize a list of ideas and topics from a variety of disciplines. Innovators are good at making sense of novel inputs and make connections across disciplines. When you ask creative people how they came up with an innovative idea, they usually say they really didn't do much at all. They just connected various experiences they have had and came up with the idea." Franz Johansson, author of The Medici Effect and The Click Moment, describes the phenomenon that occurred in the Italian Renaissance, where people of a variety of professions, including sculptors, scientists, philosophers, painters, and architects, came together to Florence, Italy, and associated ideas, spawning the Renaissance. We have seen a similar phenomenon today with the association of high-tech people in the Silicon Valley area. In cardiothoracic surgery, the idea of associating a variety of disciplines can be seen in the story about the development of the pacemaker in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Dr. Owen Wangenstein graduated in 1921 at the top of his class, and after a year internship, went to study with Drs. Plummer and Will Mayo in Rochester, Minnesota at the Mayo Clinic. Upon completion of his fellowship and a stint in Europe, he was appointed as the chair of surgery at the University of Minnesota. Here, he was able to train and assemble a remarkable group of surgeons. These included Dr. Norm Shumway, Dr. Christian Bernard, Dr. F. John Lewis, the first to perform open-heart surgery with hypothermia, Dr. Vincent Gott, and C. Walton Lillehei. At the same time, a man named Earl E. Bakken had just obtained an electrical engineering degree and with his brother-in-law founded the Medtronic Company. They would build and repair various electronic instruments used in the hospital and the labs in Minneapolis. They hung around the surgical area associating with surgeons. When C. Walton Lillehei started doing his cross-circulation operations to correct congenital heart problems, about 10% of the patients developed heart block. Vincent Gott, our STS president in 1992-93, and William Werick developed a wire that could be inserted into the wall of the ventricle to pace the heart. However, after a blackout on Halloween in 1957, which caused the patient to die, Dr. Lillehei asked Bakken if he could come up with something. Since Bakken was hanging around the surgical suite and had just read about an electronic metronome in a 1956 issue of Popular Electronics, Mr. Bakken was able to use his ability to associate the ideas and come up with a pacemaker. He made a mock-up that was the size of several card decks and gave it to Dr. Lillehei to examine. To Earl Bakken's surprise, when he came back to see if Dr. Lillehei liked it, the device was already in use. Remember, the FDA didn't start regulating medical devices until 1976. As you know, Medtronic has gone on to become a multi-billion dollar company. Earl Bakken retired in 1989 and moved to a 9-acre estate in the Kona district of Hawaii. Innovation has its rewards. Another more recent example comes from Larry Page, Google co-founder who innovated by developing an association between different ideas. As a PhD student at Stanford, he knew about the impact factor, the number of citations a journal gets each year, and how it was used to rank journals and academicians. He realized that Google could do the same with websites, ranking them with the most links to the page. This association allowed him to optimize the Google search engine that we use every day. As stated in the innovator's DNA, diversity forms the foundation for innovators to potentially connect the unconnected. We need to actively seek out diverse people and ask questions and look for new ideas to collect. Perhaps Linus Pauling, Nobel Prize-winning chemist, summed it up best by stating, "The best way to get a good idea is to get a lot of ideas." These associations need time to form. We usually don't make them during a busy day or a hectic OR schedule. We need some downtime to let these ideas come together. Another way to make new connections is to sleep on it. Harvard researchers found that a consistent way to develop connections is to get plenty of sleep. They stated, on average, a good night's sleep will give you a 33% better chance of connecting the unconnected and coming up with a great new idea. Maybe this is why tired surgeons don't perform as well as well-rested surgeons. The next skill innovators are good at is questioning. Ask why. Innovators are consummate questioners who show a passion for inquiry. For those of us in academics with surgical residents, we are often bombarded by endless questions from residents and medical students. This questioning is a good thing. It makes us think about why we do things. We should ask questions about every aspect of what we do. We should ask our patients about what's not going well for them. We should ask them about what they are most unhappy about today. By questioning, we find areas that need improvement, and the questions may spark an idea for innovation. On our postoperative floor at Mayo Clinic, every patient gets a survey the day of discharge that asks, "What could we have done better?" We have developed hundreds of innovative ideas from the responses to this question, and our patients are better off because of it. It provides us with a steady stream of ideas to develop and work on. Another example of questionings comes from a Dr. William Hunter, a cardiologist who asked, "How can we build a better stent? And what does the body do with these stents, and why do they fail?" He went on to be the co-inventor of the Taxus drug-eluting coronary stent, and now is CEO of a $12 billion company. You start to see a pattern here. Innovation turns out to be very profitable. Things that may stop us from asking questions are, one, not wanting to look stupid, and not wanting to be viewed as uncooperative or disagreeable. We learn not to ask questions as a child as a defense mechanism from getting teased by our peers, and this habit follows us into adulthood. However, after surviving a surgical residency, you should have enough self-confidence to ask almost anything. It's important to be mindful that you're not being disrespectful when you ask too many questions. One suggestion is to preface questions by stating, "I often ask a bunch of dumb questions, so here goes." This may help to mitigate the burden of asking multiple questions. Another way to come up with questions is to use them to impose constraints. It turns out that creativity loves constraints. So by adding limits to a problem, it may actually be helpful. For an example of how constraints helped one team of scientists to innovate, I want to show a short video about the Mars Curiosity lander. Constraints were numerous for these engineers. Mars is about 150 million miles away. It takes 14 minutes for light to travel that far, so communications are extremely limited. The rover weighs over a ton, and it has to land right next to a 6-kilometer mountain to get the best geological information. And all of these constraints have to fit into governmental budgetary constraints. Please watch.
When people look at it, it looks crazy. That's a very natural thing. Sometimes when we look at it, it looks crazy. It is the result of reasoned engineering thought.
but it still looks crazy. From the top of the atmosphere, down to the surface, it takes us 7 minutes. It takes 14 minutes or so for the signal from the spacecraft to make it to Earth. That's how far Mars is away from us. So when we first get word that we've touched the top of the atmosphere, the vehicle has been alive or dead on the surface for at least 7 minutes.
Entry, descent, and landing, also known as EDL, is referred to as the 7 minutes of terror, because we've got literally 7 minutes to get from the top of the atmosphere to the surface of Mars, going from 13,000 miles an hour to zero, in perfect sequence, perfect choreography, perfect timing, and the computer has to do it all by itself with no help from the ground. If any one thing doesn't work just right, it's game over.
We slam into the atmosphere and develop so much aerodynamic drag. Our heat shield, it heats up and it glows like the surface of the sun. 1600 degrees.
During entry, the vehicle is not only slowing down violently through the atmosphere, but also we are guiding it like an airplane to be able to land in a very narrow constrained space. This is one of the biggest challenges that we're facing, and one that we had never attempted on Mars.
Mars is actually really hard to slow down because it has just enough atmosphere that you have to deal with it. Otherwise, it will destroy your spacecraft. On the other hand, it doesn't have enough atmosphere to finish the job. We're still going about 1,000 miles an hour. So at that point, we use a parachute.
The parachute is the largest and strongest supersonic parachute that we've ever built to date. It has to be able to withstand 65,000 pounds of force, even though the parachute itself only weighs about 100 pounds.
When it opens up that fast, it's a neck-snapping 9 Gs.
At that point, we have to get that heat shield off. It's like a big lens cap blocking our view of the ground to the radar. The radar has to take just the right altitude and velocity measurements at just the right time, or the rest of the landing sequence won't work.
This big, huge parachute that we've got, it'll only slow us down to about 200 miles an hour. And that's not slow enough to land. So we have no choice, but we've got to cut it off and come down in rockets. Once we turn those rocket motors on, if we don't do something, we're just going to smack right back into the parachute. So the first thing we do is make this really radical divergent maneuver. We fly off to the side.
Diverting away from the parachute, killing our horizontal velocity and our vertical velocity, getting the rover moving straight up and down so it can look at the surface with its radar and see where we're going to land. And we head straight down to the bottom of a crater right beside a 6-kilometer-high mountain.
We can't get those rocket engines too close to the ground, because if we were to descend propulsively with our engines all the way to the ground, we would essentially create this massive dust cloud. That dust cloud could then go and land on the rover. It could damage mechanisms and it could damage instruments. So the way we solve that problem is by using the sky crane maneuver.
20 meters above the surface, we have to lower the rover below us on a tether that's 21 feet long, and then gently deposit it on its wheels on the surface.
As the rover touches down and is now on the ground, the descent stage, it's in a collision course with the rover. We must cut the bridle immediately and fly the descent stage to a safe distance from the rover.
That innovative, crazy idea actually worked perfectly in reality, and the Curiosity rover continues to send back valuable information today from the surface of Mars. The next skill that innovators are better at than non-innovators is observing. Innovators are intense observers. They carefully watch the world around them. To improve this skill, you should actively watch patients to see what they are trying to get from the medical system. Learn to look for surprises or anomalies, as Dwyer et al. States. An example in the medical field is Gary Crocker. He was a salesman for medical catheters and tubings for cardiac surgery. He observed that there weren't any good plumbing tools for cardiac surgeons. He went on to start his own company and develop some of the tools we use today. Incidentally, he sold his startup, Research Medical Incorporated, to Baxter International for $236 million, once again illustrating the fact that innovation is profitable. Chuck Templeton, the founder of the app Open Table, which some of you may use today to get a dinner reservation for tonight, came up with the idea while observing his wife struggle to make a dinner reservation when their relatives came to visit them in Chicago. By using his observation skills, he was able to realize an easier way to do it was needed and develop the Open Table app. The app currently has over 32,000 restaurants in it and has greatly simplified the process of getting something to eat. Observational skills can be improved by traveling to new countries, visiting different industries, attending unusual conferences, visiting museums or other unusual locations. Take some time to get out of your daily routine and observe a different activity. Another skill that innovators excel at is networking. I don't mean the type of networking that involves going around to meet people at various social events or scientific meetings. I mean idea networking. This involves spending time working with people of a variety of fields to build bridges into different areas of knowledge by interacting with others in a different area of interest. Innovators make a conscious effort to meet people with different educational backgrounds who hail from different countries, industries, and businesses. Ron Burt, a sociologist from the University of Chicago, wrote the paper Structural Holes and Good Ideas. For this work, he interviewed 673 managers in a large United States electronics firm and found those who had a large network of contacts outside the usual management structure, consistently generated more high-value ideas. Methods to improve your networking ideas include attending conferences that present ideas, such as the TED Talks or the Aspen Idea Festivals. I would also suggest, as Keith Ferrazzi, author of Never Eat Alone, says, identify the people in your industry who always seem to be out in front, and use all the relationship skills you've acquired to connect with them. Take them out to lunch, read their newsletters. Eventually, this knowledge will build on itself, and you'll start to make connections that others aren't. The final skill that innovators excel at is experimentation. They are good at trying out new ideas. Take the story of Dr. Gibbon. He must have done thousands of experiments in the development of the heart-lung machine. Innovative people use experimentation to find out if their ideas work. This doesn't mean going into the lab and designing a complex experiment. They do experimentation on a day-to-day basis. They take apart processes and try out new ones to see if they are better. This is how they can answer the why questions that come up. To see how a complex system behaves after it changes, experiment with it and record the outcome. Jeff Bezos of Amazon provides a great example. He was working at a Wall Street investment firm in 1994 and came across an article that stated that the internet was growing at 2,300% per year. With this in mind, he asked the question, would people buy things remotely? Highlighting his ability in the questioning skill of innovators as well. He went on to experiment with an online store called Earth's Biggest Bookstore. He then experimented with selling all types of goods online and building a number of 85,000 square foot warehouses across the country. We know this now as Amazon.com, and I would bet the vast majority of you use it. After this was up and running, Jeff Bezos decided to continue his experiments with the Kindle Reader, which cornered 90% of the market until the iPad came out in 2010. Now Bezos is experimenting with server computing services known as Amazon EC2. He leverages Amazon servers and computer equipment to rent out server space at a very low cost. Some estimate that 25% of small to medium-sized companies are using the Amazon EC2 servers. He has used the power of experimentation to develop his ideas into a multi-billion dollar business. There are three different ways that innovators develop their experimentation skills. First, they try out new experiences, such as traveling in a foreign country to learn a new skill. Second, they take processes apart, or they take processes or products apart to deconstruct them and to develop a new idea. In 1980, Michael Dell convinced his parents to buy him a new Apple II computer, and the first thing he did with it, much to the horror of his parents, since computers were pretty expensive back then, was to take the thing apart. This experiment gave him the idea that he could build and sell computers by component online, leading to the formation of the Dell Computer Company. Finally, innovators test ideas through prototypes and pilot projects. In the surgical area, a new pathway for postoperative care could be piloted in a hospital to see if it's effective. By developing these skills, associating, questioning, observing, networking, and experimenting, anyone in this audience can become a better innovator. Innovation not only involves coming up with a new idea or process, but it must be disseminated to make a difference. This is very difficult to do in medicine. An extreme story illustrates this point. For years, scurvy was a serious threat to naval crews. When Vasco da Gama sailed to India from Lisbon, Portugal in 1497, over 60% of his crew died of scurvy. The cause of death at the time was unknown. Scurvy is a terrible affliction. It causes bleeding of the gums, shortness of breath, bone pain, jaundice, and death occurs with generalized edema, fever, and convulsions. Not a pleasant way to die. In 1601, about 100 years after Vasco da Gama's voyages, Captain James Lancaster, commander of four ships that sailed from England to India, carried out an experiment during the voyage. On one of the ships, he gave each crew member 3 teaspoons of lemon juice each day. At the halfway point of the voyage, some 40% of the sailors on the other ships had died, but no one on the ships where the sailors were given lemon juice. Unfortunately, no one followed up on the finding, and sailors continued to die and suffer from scurvy. In 1747, the British naval physician James Lynn did a similar study and again showed that citrus fruits prevented the disease. However, it was not till 1865, some 264 years after the initial discovery, that the British Board of Trade adopted the policy and eliminated scurvy. One can quickly think of other medical innovations that were slow to be adopted. For example, the use of sterile technique in surgery was not initially adopted. Even today, the problem exists. Just think how long it's taken for the acceptance of using the internal mammary artery as a bypass conduit or taking out lymph nodes at the time of a lung cancer resection. Follow-up with implementation of an innovation requires deliberate effort. Leadership should seek out and support innovators. Hospital systems should develop deliberate systems for dissemination of improvements and make those that are early adopters more visible to others in the organization. Dissemination of innovation takes time and energy. Surgeons that are trapped in the throes of production and existing at the margins of resources are not going to have time to take on new innovative ideas. Leadership needs to realize that dissemination of innovation takes time and resources, and not providing for them for innovation will lead to certain obscurity. Another reason that implementation of innovation is difficult is that, in general, surgeons don't like change. They believe that procedures or practices that have historically worked must be preserved and go on forever. To illustrate this, I want to tell you a story about the steel industry. Something that, growing up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, in an industry that my dad and I worked in, is near and dear to me. Historically, making steel has been a complicated process, and for years has been done in something called integrated mills. This involves taking coal, iron ore, and limestone, and creating cast iron, and then taking the cast iron ingots and injecting oxygen into them and transforming the cast iron into steel. The steel is then shaped into I-beams, pipe, sheet metal, or whatever the customer orders. This integrated mill uses a massive amount of energy to heat and reheat the raw elements. The cost of building a mill like this is $1 to $2 billion. An innovative method of making steel was discovered in the early 70s. It involved taking recycled steel, or scrap, heating it in an electric furnace, and remolding the steel into what was needed, I-beam, pipe, sheet metal, etc. The cost is a fraction of what it would cost to make the steel from the old integrated mills. Shortly after one of these mini mills, as they are called, appeared in the United States, a large steel company acquired it. The mini mill grew rapidly and generated cash and was extremely profitable. However, top management vetoed the project, stating, "The integrated steel process is the only right one," and they sold off or closed the mini mills. Needless to say, the United States steel industry did not see the coming revolution that mini mills brought. Employment has fallen over 500%. The economies of the steel cities in Cleveland and Pittsburgh have been severely affected, and now most steel is made in other countries. Since management could not accept that the old way was not going to last forever, the United States steel industry has suffered. I urge you not to fall into the same trap as the steel industry did. Just because an operation or a process has been around for a long time and may seem normal, an innovative idea can change it all. Be open to this change. Look for this type of innovative change. Embrace it and see if you can use it to do things better for your patient. Richard Branson, founder of Virgin Incorporated, said, care about something enough to do something about it. We all care about our patients and our specialty, so let's do something about them. Now is the time for you to practice and develop these innovation skills. By developing and using the skills I've reviewed today, associating, questioning, observing, networking, and experimenting, you can develop new processes, operations, and procedures that will help our patients. It's hard work, but it's worth the effort, because it just may make the difference not only in your life, but in the lives of others. But the time is now. Don't wait till another year goes by, for as Warren Miller says about heli-skiing, waiting will just mean you're a year older when you get to do it. The professional life of a cardiothoracic surgeon is short, so get to it. In Steve Jobs' commencement speech at Stanford in 2005, he mentioned the quote, "If you live long enough, if you live each day as if it was your last, someday you'll most certainly be right." He went on to say, "Remembering that I'll be dead soon is the most important tool I've ever encountered to help me make the big choices in life. Because almost everything, all external expectations, all pride, all fear of embarrassment or failure, these things just fall away in the face of death, leaving only what is truly important. Our time is limited, which is why you should go away from this meeting and think how you can use these tools this week to make a difference. Jot down some ideas on the plane ride home and try them out at your hospital. Cardiothoracic surgery is the best specialty in medicine, and we are very lucky to be able to practice in this specialty. By using these skills, associating, questioning, observing, networking, and experimenting to innovate for better processes, procedures, and outcomes, we can make our specialty even better." Being the president of the Society of Thoracic Surgeons has been a tremendous honor for me. I thank you for listening this morning and giving me the privilege of being your president this year. Thank you.